In its purest form, the presuppositionalist would say, I'm not arguing for a conclusion, I'm arguing from a conclusion. The conclusion is that God exists, and everything else makes sense in view that God is there. And if you don't have that conclusion at the start, not at the finish, but at the start, then whatever comes from that will be complete rubbish and nonsense. In its softer view, in the Schaeffer view, it's just the only view that can be content and consistent, or in Schaeffer's view, the upper story and the lower story, or to use the language of modern philosophy, the fact-value split. I like to call this the desperate dilemma, that either you could be content with your worldview, but you're not consistent, or you're consistent with your worldview, but you're not content. You're desperate and despairing. And so we're arguing that only a theistic worldview would fit this picture. Can that be argued? Whoa, if it could, this would be one heck of an argument, and I think it can. We'd like to look at four different areas. The first would be significance. Here's a picture taken from the Voyager spacecraft as it left our solar system. And it was taking a picture of the planet Earth, and this was the final picture that made it to us of the planet Earth. What Carl Sagan referred to as a pale blue dot. That's the planet Earth. When you think about that, the planet Earth is surrounded by the universe, and you ask, you know, does the universe have significance? Well, I think you would have to say no. The universe does not have any significance. It's a bunch of matter and energy and chemicals, and no, that doesn't have any significance. Well, then do the things within the universe have significance? Like the planet Earth. Does the Earth have significance? Well, it's just a pale blue dot floating through the vacuum of space. No, it doesn't have any significance. Well, what about the things on the planet Earth, like humanity? Do we have any significance? Again, moving down from the universe to the Earth to humanity, what is the significance? And then the final question is, do I have any significance? On a theistic worldview, yes, we do. We have an objective significance because we're made in the image of God. We're bound for heaven. We're loved. The things that we do have eternal significance and meaning and purpose. But on an atheistic or naturalistic worldview, even a pantheistic or animistic or polytheistic worldview, from where do you get significance? Years ago, I was sitting with my grandfather before he passed, and he was putting up pictures, old pictures, black and white pictures of him when he was a little boy. And he said, do you know who that is? And I was like, no. He's like, that's your great-granduncle. I didn't know I had a great-granduncle, you know. He said, do you know who that is? No. He said, that's your great-grandfather. I was like, I don't know what he looks like, you know. Do you know who that is? I was like, no. A little boy in the picture. He's like, that's me. And that's your aunt so-and-so, and that's your great-grand... And he started listing off all the people. And I was looking at this picture. It was on his computer. He got it scanned in. I was looking at it, realizing I couldn't pick any of these people out in a lineup. And these people, for them, many people, most people alive today, they say, what's your significance? They say, well, it's to have kids and have a family. Think about that for a second. Your great-grandchildren won't even be able to know your name or know what you look like. So far from having like any kind of significance like hundreds of years from now, let's just get real practical here. Like in 100 years, no one will know who you were. They'll look at you on a piece of paper and not know your name. How many of you have 8 great-grandparents? How many of you could name all of your 8 great-grandparents? I can't name one. I don't know one name. You think about this math equation. I used to write this out when I was a grade schooler. 21 plus 52 minus 108 plus 231 plus 675, all in parentheses, of course, times zero. And people would put that together, you know, 21 plus 52, that's 73, minus 108, that's negative, and then plus 231, plus 6. And they get to the end and they realize times zero. Why'd I do this stupid math problem? It's zero. If you, no matter what you do in the parentheses, if it was 21,000 in the parentheses, plus 52, minus 108, plus 231, plus 675, times zero is zero. What if it was 21 million plus 52, minus 108, plus 231, plus 675, times zero? Still zero. What if it was 21 billion plus 52 minus 108 plus 231? Okay, you're not getting the point, right? Anything that ends in zero is zero. And so when you think about your life, you could be a plus 21 or you could be a minus 108. But in the end, it all ends the same way. Whether you're a Mother Teresa or an Adolf Hitler, it ends in death. The heat death of the universe and the collective extinction of the human race. Think about it like this. You crash land on a desert island, and it's you and just a couple other people. And, you know, you raid the plane for any supplies you can get, and you're starting to realize that you've only got enough food and supplies to last you maybe another, I don't know, 3-4 days. And you're thinking to yourself, you know, what are we going to do on this island? Well, what could give you meaning and significance in those 3 or 4 days? Think about that for a second. Okay, you could do a bunch of carvings on the coconuts that fall off the trees. You could raid the liquor cabinet on the plane that crashed and, you know, make, you know, coconut cocktails, I guess. You could work on your suntan and, you know, get a really nice tan right before you die. But none of those things would be meaningful. None of those things would be significant given 3 or 4 days. Now you ask yourself the question, well, what if the island wasn't like a square mile? What if it was 10 square miles? Oh, would that give you significance and meaning? No, you're not getting it because it's not the size of the island that gives you meaning and significance. That's a category error, right? Error. It's not the size of the island that's the issue. It's what? Is it, what if we went to the other side of the island and like the show Lost, we find the others over there. So instead of 3 or 4 survivors, we find, let's say, 300 or 400 survivors. Would that give you meaning? I don't see how, because if 3 or 4 survivors don't have meaning, why would adding survivors add meaning, add significance? That can't be the solution to it. What about, you come in and you find a bunch of fresh water, a fresh water reserve, and a source of food and game and hunting, and you realize instead of extending our time for 3 or 4 days, we can extend it for 3 or 4 months, 3 or 4 years, 30 years, 40 years. Would that give you meaning and significance in what you did on the island? No, you're not getting it. It's not the size of the island. It's not the population of the island. It's not the amount of time that you spend on the island. Meaning and significance is something completely different. And the purpose of this analogy is to demonstrate that we are on the island. It's called planet Earth, and it has a circumference of 25,000 miles. It has a population of 7.5 billion people. And instead of 3 or 4 days, maybe you'll get 3 or 4 years or 30 or 40 years or 70 to 80 years. But in the absence of God, in a godless universe, there is no meaning. Adding the population, adding the size, adding the time doesn't add meaning or significance. The French existentialist understood this well. Albert Camus, in his book, The Fall, he says, "For anyone who is alone, without God and without a master, the weight of days is dreadful." Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, in his book, Being and Nothingness, he says, "Thus, it amounts to the same thing, whether one gets drunk alone or is a leader of nations." He also says in his short story, The Wall, in the story, I believe it's during the Spanish Civil War, one of the main characters gets captured, and the next day they're going to put him to death, shooting by a firing squad against the wall. And as he's thinking about his own mortality, the protagonist of the short story says this, "In the state I was in, if someone had come and told me I could go home quietly, you know, from prison, that they would leave me my whole life, it would have left me cold. Several hours or several years of waiting is all the same when you have lost the illusion of being eternal." So his point is this, whether he's going to die by firing squad tomorrow, or they say you can go home, and he's realizing, I'm going to go home, but eventually I'm going to die. Several days, several years. Once you realize that there is no eternal life, it leaves you cold, it leaves you lost. Robert Plant, I put him in my top 3 or 4 rock singers of all time from Led Zeppelin. This is from his song, That's the Way. He says, yesterday I saw you kissing tiny flowers, but all that lives is born to die. And so I say to you that nothing really matters, and all you do is stand and cry. That's true. If everything that lives is born to die, then what does it really matter? Nothing matters. And the girl in the song is just standing and crying. Of course she's crying, because she's understood the desperate dilemma. If I'm consistent with the idea that I have no significance, what am I? If I end in nothing, I am nothing. Aldous Huxley, the humanist author and philosopher, he says, there comes a time when one asks, even of Shakespeare, even of Beethoven, is this all that there is? Great idea to think about, where we realize we've had pleasure and we've had, you know, all this cavorting and playing around and making money, and yet at the end of the day, even of the classics, we reach a point where we realize, is this it? Alain de Botton, he has a school called the School of Life. It's a school for atheists. And one of the classes that he teaches is called How to Fill the God-Shaped Hole. You don't think this is a serious issue that every person faces? It is a serious issue. Why do I matter? What is the meaning of my life? So significance. On a Christian worldview, this would make complete sense. Why do I get up and put my pants on in the morning? Because I matter, that's why. Because I'm going to make an eternal impact. Because I do have a purpose. I do have a meaning. On an atheistic worldview, we're just, you know, the byproducts of chance and energy and matter, and we're about to be shaken off like a virus or a cold from this planet. Some people retort. They say, well, can't we create our own meaning? Like, I know there's not like an objective meaning. Like, objectively, there's no meaning, but I'm going to create my own meaning to life. Well. Yeah, you can do that. You can say, I'm just going to come up with my own meaning, but that's a relative or subjective meaning, meaning it pertains to the subject, you, not to the object, anything out in reality. It's the same as saying, I like mint chocolate chip ice cream. Yeah, I like it. Objectively, you could say mint chocolate chip ice cream is green. That's referring to the object out there. So it's subjective, not objective. I remember talking to a young agnostic student. We were on a beach vacation 5 years ago. We sat down and we were talking about this very thing right here. And he asked me the question. He said, well, isn't a subjective meaning good enough? And I had one of those moments where, despite what I normally would have said, for whatever reason, I shut my mouth. And I said something I didn't plan on saying. You ever have that happen? I said, I don't know. What do you think? Is that good enough? It was kind of like a I'm rubber and you're glue situation. So he started thinking about it and he goes, no, it's not good enough. Subjective, that means it's just all meaningless in the end. I thought, yeah, that's how I feel about it. So I could say I have a meaning, but what happens if my meaning and your meaning contradict? Like, what happens if I have a meaning that I want to be the best a businessman and make a Fortune 500 company? And your meaning is you want to be the best at World of Warcraft. We can't say that one meaning is more important than the other. What happens if I say I want to save the trees and you say I want to make lots of money by cutting down the trees? What if they contradict? That shows that it's not objective. What we're not saying here is that we can't have pleasure or happiness in the absence of God. Of course we can. Of course you can have pleasure. Sometimes people say, well, I found meaning. What is it? I like to play with my kids. Okay, that's pleasure. That's happiness. That's not meaning. Well, I found meaning. I like to ride my bike. That makes you feel good. No one's arguing that you need God to feel good or to pick up a toddler and think that they're cute. No one's arguing that. We're saying meaning. What does it matter? Not how does it make me feel, but why does it matter? All right, number two, what is the explanation for equality? On a biblical worldview, we've got answers here. What about on a naturalistic worldview? Well, let's think about this subject of equality. If I was to say I got a trade, I'm going to give you a dollar if you give me four quarters. Would that be equal? Yeah. What if I said to you, I'd like to trade you a six-pack of beer for six beers. would that be equal? Presuming it's the same kind of beer and one beer isn't skunked and so forth. Yeah, that'd be equal. That'd be fine. Now, what if I said Stephen Hawking is equal to LeBron James? Is that true? Is that the same as saying a dollar is equal to four quarters? No. Clearly not. Clearly they're not equal. Some people would say, well, they're both human. True. Yeah, that's right. That's right. They're Homo sapiens. Yes. They're in the same species. Yes, yes, yes. They're both human, but that doesn't mean they're both equal. Some people would say, yeah, but they have attributes in common. Yeah. They have big brains. They have four limbs. They have one heart. They have two kidneys. They have a stomach. Yeah, but just because they have things in common doesn't mean that they're equal. For example, a Toyota Corolla and a Porsche have things in common. They both have one engine, four wheels, and so forth. But they're not equal cars. Give me a break. If you really think that these two men are equal, then you, basically what you're saying is, you think that LeBron James should be able to publish papers in peer-reviewed journals on astrophysics. And you think that Stephen Hawking should be able to try out for the NBA. No, let me take that back. You think Stephen Hawking should make millions of dollars playing in the NBA. Obviously that's not true. Obviously they are not equal. How much more obvious could it be? What would we need to say that these two men who are so different are actually equal? Well, we would need something not human doing, like their function, but something about them being human being, in their very being. What would have to be true? You need two things. In order for equality to exist, you need something that's objectively true, not something I'm just thinking up, and something that's truly important. Like, is it objectively true that they both have belly buttons? Yeah, that's objectively true. Is it truly important? No. Is it objectively true that they're both members of the human species? Yes. But is that truly important? I think so, but why? Why is it important? Well, it just is. So we can just make this up. We can just say it just is. Why? What's the reason? Under the biblical worldview, it is objectively true that both of these men, different as they are made in the image of God. And both of these men are so valuable to God that he was willing to die for both of them. How does Paul put it? The Son of God did not just die, he died for me. Galatians 2:20. And so too, he died for Stephen Hawking, and he died for LeBron James, and he died for every man, woman, boy, and girl on planet Earth. Now, if that's true, that's truly important, and it's objective. If that's the case, we have a basis upon which to have true equality for persons. If you don't have this basis, if you don't have this foundation, this leads to serious problems. Ayn Rand, she was an ethical egoist. Basically, ethics come from self, the ego. And so if I don't like it, if I don't appreciate it, then it's wrong. It comes from the self. So she writes in her book, Philosophy, Who Needs It? She says egalitarianism, equality, is so evil and so silly a doctrine that it deserves no serious study or discussion. Yeah, to a really high, affluent intellectual like Ayn Rand, the thought that she would be considered equal with a dummy over here, an idiot, or a poor person, or somebody of a different race, or a different class, or from a different sociological strata, oh, that's just, how does she put it? Silly, evil of a doctrine. Yeah, equality. Friedrich Nietzsche, the famous 19th century German atheist, he says, another Christian concept has passed even more deeply into the tissue of modernity. What is it? What is the Christian concept? The concept of the equality of souls before God. He says, this concept furnishes the prototype of all theories of equal rights. What an admission. More recently, Richard Rorty, the pragmatic philosopher, pragmatist, he says this Jewish and Christian element in our tradition, he's talking about equality in context, is gratefully invoked by freeloading atheists like myself. Do you see what he's admitting to there? He doesn't have a basis to say why every person on earth is equal, because he doesn't believe in God. And there's no foundation, there's no basis for saying that they're equal. So he says he has to freeload off of a Christian worldview to say that all people are equal. On a Christian worldview, we have no problem with this. That even if somebody isn't functioning properly, even if somebody doesn't have a high IQ, if somebody isn't as athletic or fast or strong, it doesn't matter. All people are made in the image of God. The equality of souls before God, as Nietzsche put it. What about another area to explore? Objective morality. Here's a syllogism that's valid. Valid means it's internally consistent. Let's see this here. Premise one, every event in the universe is natural. Yeah, to a naturalist, everything in nature, that's all that there is. So it can't be anything other than natural. Every event in the universe is natural. Number two, moral atrocities are events in the universe. That would have to be true. You know, whether a Rwandan genocide or a Holocaust or whatever, those are events in the universe. And so therefore, three, moral atrocities are natural. Another way of putting this is, how can you look at everything in the world and say it's all natural, it's all naturalism, except for when somebody does something evil? That was wrong. They shouldn't have done that. They ought not to have done that. That's like looking at water over a Bunsen burner, and it's up to 212 degrees and it's boiling, and you say, that ought not boil. It's nature. That's what nature does. It's like looking at a lion chasing down a gazelle. That's what lions do. It's like looking at a race of aphids enslaving a race of ants. No one's protesting ant slavery. That's just nature. That's the way that it is. But why is it different when it's humans? Well, under a Christian worldview, we would have a basis for a moral law. What do you need to have an objective moral law? You need an objective moral lawgiver. One who is transcendent of nature, one who is ultimately and completely good, and one who is good in his nature and issues laws which themselves are good. You also need moral accountability. What use is there if you lived in a nation where you had laws but you never had any accountability? Be no reason not to break the laws. And so this is exactly what we have in a Christian worldview. Objective morality. Moral values, duties, and accountability. On an atheistic worldview, very, very difficult to see how you could have objective moral values, duties, and accountability. Here's Richard Dawkins. This is from his book, The Devil's Chaplain. He says that when we say that humans are so important, this is, quote, flagrant speciesism and human speciest vanity. Do you know what speciesism is? You know what racism is? That's where you put one race in an unjustified way above another race, right? That's racism. Or sexism, where you put one sex above another sex in an unjustified way. Dawkins says when we put humans above all the other species out there, that's speciesism. Who says? Why are humans at the top of the pack? Why are we valuable and the other things out there are less valuable? That's flagrant speciesism, human speciest vanity. George Carlin, the atheistic comedian, he said, how come when it's us, it's an abortion, and when it's a chicken, it's an omelet? That's a good question. Why is it that when a woman miscarries, or if a woman is kicked in the stomach and loses her baby, she goes through grief, and yet when a chicken loses a baby in its egg, we cook it, we eat it. It's just nature. Richard Carrier, the atheistic historian, this is from his book, Sense and Goodness Without God, A Defense of Metaphysical Naturalism. Now, this is a long book. He's well thought out on this. Look at what he says. A human baby has more value than any animal on earth. That's true. I agree with that. With the possible exception of adult apes or dolphins or perhaps elephants. Under his view, it's not human being. If you're a member of the human race, you're a human being and you're being, you're human. Under his view, it's human doing. A little baby doesn't have cognition. A human baby doesn't have consciousness yet where it can connect. But he's arguing that these other animals do. And so you might say, yeah, but eventually that baby's going to mature into a human that can have sentience and everything else. Yes, it will in the future, but not now. Peter Singer, he's a bioethicist at Princeton. He says humans who bestow superior value on the lives of all human beings solely because they are members of our own species are judging along lines strikingly similar to those used by white racists who bestow superior value on the lives of other whites merely because they are members of their own race. So the fact that you value humans as important and give them dignity and value, that's just as arbitrary as racism and picking a certain white race or black race or whatever else. Singer says, why should we believe that the mere fact that a being is a member of the species Homo sapiens endows its life with some unique, almost infinite value? Why indeed? Why are humans important? We're a sack of chemicals and juices. We're an electrochemical machine. That's all we are, unless there is a God who imparts and imbues us with value and dignity and worth. Then that would change the entire perspective, wouldn't it? Here's Singer. This is from his graduate textbook, Practical Ethics. He says, human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping that they exist over time. They are not persons. So this is the fact-value divide. A human being versus a human doing. A human being versus a human person. So in order to qualify as a human person, like somebody that we shouldn't just kill for any reason, you have to have certain properties. In this case, you need to be self-aware. And if you have self-awareness, now you have value. Is this frightening anyone else? This is from a Princeton professor's textbook. So if you lose self-awareness, like if obviously none of us had it when we were babies, and we're probably going to lose it when we become very aged. We lose it actually every day when we go to sleep. We're not self-aware. If we go into a coma, we don't have self-awareness. If we're anesthetized, we don't have self-awareness. So you could have that property, but if you lose it, you might be a human being, but you're not a human person. And so you lose value. So Singer says, the life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. That's just really biting the ethical bullet right there. That these other species have more awareness than a newborn baby. And if you don't have that property... Now, the biblical view is the inclusivist view. It's saying if you're a member of the human species, you're in. You have value. It doesn't matter what you do. It matters what you are. The fact that you are a human being made in the image of God. Jeffrey Ryman, atheistic philosopher. He says the killing of infants is wrong because of an emotion that we naturally and rightly have toward infants. That's interesting. See, I would have said it's wrong because it's wrong to kill the infant. Like it's wrong objectively out there. The object, baby killing, like stabbing a baby and killing it, that's wrong. Not that how I feel about it. That's irrespective to what's happening out there. No, it's not how I feel. It is wrong. He says adults and children possess in their own right a property that makes it wrong to kill them. Infants, for the moment, do not. Again, you take away a property, and this is so arbitrary. Why do we pick sentience? Why do we pick self-awareness? Why do we pick cognition? This is the foundation of every horrific moral, moral atrocity that's ever happened. Think of Nazi Germany. They had the phrase, life unworthy of life, where they killed off people with mental disabilities. They killed off people that were deformed. And why? Because they weren't worthy of life. That's why. James Rachels, atheistic ethicist. He says, some unfortunate humans, perhaps because they have suffered brain damage, are not rational agents. What are we to say about them? Yeah, like what happens if you get hit in the head too hard? The natural conclusion, he says, according to the doctrine we are considering, would be that their status is that of mere animals. And perhaps we should go on to conclude that they may be used as non-human animals are used, perhaps as laboratory subjects or as food. Of course, traditional moralists do not accept any such conclusion. No kidding. We should not treat a person worse merely because he has been so unfortunate, we might say. But this idea will not bear close inspection. Now, from a naturalistic perspective, I just pounded you with quote after quote after quote. What's wrong with that thinking? What's wrong with it from a naturalistic perspective? Nothing is wrong with it. Because in order for something to be wrong, you need to have a standard outside of nature to say that you're comparing it with. Well, let's think up a number of different objections here. Some people say that under naturalism, morality is just a brute fact. This is cute. Walter Sinan Armstrong, atheistic philosopher, he says there is just plain morality. He's just an assertion, a bald assertion. He says, what's immoral about causing serious harms to other people without justification? But now it seems natural to answer. It simply is, objectively. Don't you agree? Well, of course we agree. The question is not, do we agree? The question is, why is it wrong? This isn't a bad explanation. This isn't a good explanation. This is no explanation. This is just making a plain assertion. What about another explanation is that we get our morality from emotions. This was the view of David Hume and the logical positivist A.J. Ayer. Here's Hume. He says, vice and virtue, so evil and good, are the object of feeling, not of reason. It lies in yourself, not in the object. So for someone to say, I get morality from my feelings, yeah, you know, thinking about a baby being killed, ooh, that just makes my skin crawl, makes me feel uncomfortable. Oh, ugh, that would just make me nauseated if I saw that or heard about it. Yeah, but we're not talking about you. We're saying, what's the basis for objective morality? The object, what's wrong out there? This is just flat out admitting that it isn't objective. It's subjective. It lies in yourself, not the person out there. Others say we get morality from evolution. Here's Michael Shermer. He says, the moral sense of feeling good or feeling bad about behavior X, whatever X may be, is an evolved human universal. By a moral sense, I mean a moral feeling or emotion generated by actions. Why should we be moral is like asking, why should we be hungry or why should we be horny? He's saying that evolution bred in a certain instinct or impulse or throb or urge into the human species. And so when it says, why should I be moral, like do something good and not do something bad, it's like asking, why should I be hungry or why should I want to have sex? It's just an urge. A throb, a feeling, an instinct. That's all it is. Franz de Waal, the atheistic primatologist, calls this a benevolent impulse. Benevolent means good, a good impulse. Do you see what's the problem with this, saying we get the concept of morality from evolution? For one, evolution, by definition, is not objective. Because evolution, by definition, means change over time. However you cut it, any way you look at it. So morality, if it's objective, like if it was always wrong to use people for slaves, chattel slaves, if it was always wrong to kill innocents, infants, then evolution, by definition, would deny that it's change over time. It could change, and that is not objective. There's just no way around this. Secondly, this is arguing in a circle. It's saying that we're looking out at the world, let's say our nearest cousins, the bonobos, the chimps, the apes, and we're saying they have certain like troop behavior, and so they work together collectively, and so we got that from a shared common ancestor. Okay, cool. So there's troop behavior. So is the troop behavior good? Well, yeah, it is good. Well, that's the question. Where do we get the idea of good? What's the foundation for good? We can't look to the natural order and say, oh, look, troop behavior. That's good. That's where we got goodness from. But wait a minute. We look over here and they're eating each other's young and we say, bad. That's bad over there. Yeah, but what's the foundation to say that's bad and that's good? This is begging the question. This is arguing in a circle. This doesn't account for moral praise. If it's a benevolent impulse, if it's just an impulse or a throb or an urge or an instinct, that's equivalent to somebody having blonde hair and blue eyes. If it's programmed into us via evolution and sociology, we couldn't have done otherwise. This confuses description with prescription. Evolution is a descriptive process. It describes how life came to be. It doesn't prescribe anything. It shows us what is the case. It doesn't show us what should or ought be the case. And a final question, just to really tease this out here, a benevolent impulse. That's begging the question, first of all. You're calling that impulse good. What's your basis for good? That's the question. But here's the question. What if you have a sadistic impulse to kill, and then you got another impulse to love and sacrifice? So you got an impulse to torture someone, and then you got an impulse to give your money to someone who's needy. What happens if a sadistic impulse overpowers a sacrificial impulse? Which impulse is right and which impulse is wrong? Can't you see, under this view, neither. Neither. We're coming up with names to describe impulses, but none of this is a prescriptive process. What about reason? We just come up with rules. This is my favorite. So we just come up with this. We just develop it. So what if I just came up with the idea, yeah, I think that there's a God, and we're just going to act like there is a God. Does that work? Like, we can just, like, make this stuff up? Would any atheist accept that? Yeah, I'm just going to come up with an idea that there is a God, and we're going to pretend like he's there, and that's why we're going to do that. No, they would say no. What's the foundation for there being a God? How do you know that? So reason. We're just going to come up with reason, and then the reason's going to tell us what's right and wrong? No. Kai Nielsen, he says, we have not been able to show that reason requires the moral point of view, or that all really rational persons should not be individual egoists or classical moralists. Reason doesn't decide here. The picture I have painted for you is not a pleasant one. Reflection on it depresses me. Pure, practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to morality. Reason is necessary to do moral thinking. Reason is not sufficient. Reason is necessary to do science. Reason is not sufficient. Reason is necessary. Anything we do, you need reason, but it's not sufficient. What about culture or law? Here's Paul Kurtz. We get morality from culture, or we get it from law. Kurtz says moral principles that govern our behavior are rooted in what? Habit and custom, feeling and fashion. So where do we get morality, ethics? Well, we get it from our habits, custom, feeling, and fashion. So, you know, it's not fashionable in our country to belch loudly at the dinner table. But maybe if you live in a different country, it is fashionable. And so what's morality? It's kind of like that. It's like wearing white socks with a suit. You know, okay, that's like a social taboo. But in our culture, that's wrong. But maybe somewhere else, it's okay. Okay. Under this view, morality is just taboo. It's just something that people look at and say, you're a deviant. You don't fit in with the pack. But if that's the foundation for morality, you got a number of problems. Number one, you can't have moral progress. Why? Because if culture is the standard for morality, and you've got moral progress, like let's say, we just celebrated MLK Day, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We're saying that was a moral progress, wasn't it, with racism in America? Wait a minute. If the standard is culture, and now we've moved 40, 50 years into the future, and now we had racism more, and now we have it less, that's not moral progress, that's moral change. The only way you have progress is if you have an absolute standard against which you're comparing your culture. Otherwise, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like going bowling, but you don't know if you're supposed to get a 300 or a zero. You can knock down the pins all day, and you can have different scores. You can have change, but you can't have progress. You only have progress if you know that the game totals up to a 300. You can't have moral reformers under this view. When Martin Luther King Jr. was speaking out against racism in America, he was a deviant. He was standing up against what? Against the culture. But wait a minute. If the culture is the standard for morality, by definition, MLK was immoral. Unless you believe that there's a standard outside of culture to which we can appeal. But no, if culture is at the very bottom, the basis, then there's no moral reformers. In fact, they're immoral reformers. There's no such thing as an immoral law if culture is the standard. Can you ever think of anything that was legal but not moral? like child labor laws, like slavery, like the treatment of women, basically forever. And these were all legal. These things were all legal. And you're saying that's always moral? No, it wasn't always moral. Well, then you're appealing to something outside of culture. Finally, what happens if cultures disagree? What if somebody from culture A comes from a culture where they say, love your neighbor, and somebody from culture B comes from a culture where they say, eat your neighbor, and they're both on vacation in culture C? Who's right and who's wrong? Well, clearly somebody's wrong, or they're both wrong, but they can't both be right. I hope you see that. Here's a question to ask yourself. What's the difference in a world where everyone's right about morality and there is no morality? Answer, nothing. There is no difference. Basically, we're saying, we're admitting, we're making this up. There is no such thing as morality. Are you ready to bite the bullet on that? What about utilitarianism? In the words of Commander Spock, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. That's the utilitarian mantra. That basically we come up with an idea that is going to benefit the most amount of people. And under this view, individuals should be taken care of, but only insofar as they are part of the collective. So under utilitarian view, if we've got a highway that's coming through and it's really going to benefit like thousands or millions of people, if we have a highway coming through, we should blow down your house because it's getting in the way. Individuals don't have rights under utilitarianism. The culture, the greater cause has rights, but not individuals. So Jeremy Bentham, this is back, he's the originator of utilitarianism back in the 18th century. He says, natural rights is simple nonsense. Natural and imprescriptible rights, rhetorical nonsense. Nonsense upon stilts. So what's he saying? The idea that you have like universal human rights, that is nonsense. Rhetorical nonsense, nonsense on stilts. We see this theme come up in the movie Endgame with the Avengers, where, what's his face, big guy? Thanos, yes, death. Yeah, I really like that movie for that reason. The Avengers say we don't trade lives for lives. We won't kill Vision to save, you know, the 50% of the life in the universe or whatever. But Thanos will kill his own daughter in order to fulfill his agenda. And so that's a good example of what are called utilitarian ethics. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few versus what are called deontological ethics, where something is just right and it's right because it's right. What's wrong with utilitarianism? Under this view, if you were in a hospital and you had somebody who was waiting on a kidney and on a heart and on a lung and on a liver and whatever else, and you saw a real young, strong young man in the waiting room, it wouldn't be morally permissible to hunt him down and stick a needle in his neck and harvest his organs to heal those five people. It wouldn't be permissible. It would be morally mandatory. Because that individual doesn't have individual rights. That individual should actually sacrifice his organs to save the lives of five different people. That's utilitarianism. That's the problem with it. What about the ideal social contract? This is the idea that you put up a mask, a veil of ignorance, and somebody says to you, well, you should come up with laws and rights and everything, but you don't know if you're going to be rich or poor. You don't know what race you're going to be. You don't know what sex you're going to be. You don't know where you're going to live geographically, sociologically, financially. And you put up a veil of ignorance over yourself. And then you decide laws. And then that would be the fairest way to come up with a legal system. Kind of a good idea when you think about it. The problem is that's really good in discovering what's moral. I like that about it. My question is, who gets to stand behind the veil? More importantly, why should we listen to them? What if they stand behind the veil of ignorance and they say, well, I really want to make divorce really easy for people. Because even if I was a divorced person or trying to divorce, I would really want that. And what if you got somebody else who's on the other extreme and says, no, I don't think divorce should be easy at all. Or what if you flip-flop? What if you got somebody who's behind the veil of ignorance who says, I don't think divorce should be easy. We should get rid of no-fault divorce. And then the other person's saying, no, that's controlling, and we should let people have divorces as much as they want for any reason or no reason. Why is their assessment binding on me? In order for it to be objective, it can't just be that I make this up. It's got to be that it's binding whether I agree to it or not. Well, we could put this really simple. Did morality come from matter? How could that possibly be the case? No, we're arguing morality came from a mind, a mind. Finally, number four, free will, free will. Here's our syllogism. Number one, premise one, every event in the universe is determined by natural laws. Yes, under naturalism, I don't see anything contentious about that or questionable about that. Premise two, our thoughts and our decisions and even our actions are events in the universe. Therefore, three, our thoughts, decisions, and actions are determined by natural laws. So true. It's valid, and I don't see any problem with the premises, so it's sound. That's a sound argument. From a naturalistic perspective, in other words, there is no such thing as free will. It's an illusion. Jerry Coyne was famous for saying that we are meat machines, electrochemical machines. He said in one talk, you have just as much free will as a bowl of sugar. Because we are bowls of sugar, just very complex ones. Yes, complexity could add to our brains. Our brains are way more complex than anything else out there. But does complexity equal freedom? No. Whether you got 50 dominoes or 50,000 dominoes being knocked over, you could add 50 million dominoes. It doesn't make the succession of cause and effect sequences any more free. In fact, this is the majority view. Stephen Hawking, free will is an illusion. Sam Harris, free will is an illusion. J.L. Mackey, it's a useful illusion. Susan Blackmore, a grand illusion. Alex Rosenberg, thinking about things is an overwhelmingly powerful illusion. That's the one that really sticks out to me. Here's my question. If free will is an illusion, if it's a grand illusion, if it's a useful illusion, then who is being deluded? In order to be deluded, in order to have an illusion, you need a first-person thinking individual. A first-person self viewing the world. Now, if you got a first-person self viewing the world, that self could be deluded. They could see an illusion and think it was something else. But if you don't even have the first-person self who's conscious and aware, then who could be deluded? You can't delude a computer. You can't delude something unless you have someone who is thinking. And so this seems to be patently false. It can't be true. Well, there's a number of problems with determinism. If you're going to bite the bullet and say, well, yeah, I guess we are just a sack of juices, a bowl of sugar. I guess we are. It's if free will is an illusion. Consciousness, not real. That would mean that your mental states are an illusion. Every time you have a thought about something, you weren't having it. It was like brain gas. Just like your heart pumps blood or, you know, your organs produce bile, your brain pumps out thoughts. And so every thought you've had, including the thought about free will being an illusion, is itself an illusion. Reason is an illusion. You say, no, 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 I've got really good reasons for determinism. I've got really good reasons that free will doesn't exist. If you're determined to hold those reasons, then they don't prove anything. If you're determined to hold a reason, then how does it work in an argument? An argument only works if I'm looking at the evidence, and I'm looking at the reasons, and there's someone who is weighing the evidence back and forth and saying that's true and that's false. But if all the reasons are programmed into my brain through determinism, if it's all just a bunch of dominoes falling, if it's just brain gas, like one person, if you shook up their brain, they might fizz like Mountain Dew, and another person might fizz like Dr. Pepper. So you might fizz, you know, deterministically, and I might fizz free will, but at the end of the day, we're both just fizzing. Then reason is an illusion. It's brain gas. That's it. So too with morality. Morality would be an illusion because in order for culpability in order to say that that was wrong, what you did, we have to say that you could have done other than what you did. If somebody pushes me into you and you fall over and spill your coffee, I'm not responsible. It's the causal agent, the person who pushed me maliciously into you. I was just the body of, you know, pale skin and flesh that got pushed into you, and then you spilled your coffee. So I'm not the one responsible. But what happens if everybody is just being pushed through deterministic causes? Then this would mean everything we're doing, we can't be held responsible for. Lifelong identity is an illusion. This idea that you're the same person from birth until death is an illusion under naturalism. Why? Because a human person, all you are is cells and juices and chemicals, and yet those physical parts are being replaced constantly. Skin cells, skin flaking off, cells duplicating, cells being expelled from the body, your metabolism, chewing up cells. I mean, when we look back over years and years, we could say that that person physically, naturally, is 50% different than what they were. We could go even further and say they're 75% different than what they were, or 80%, or 90% physically different than what they were. I'll prove it. Look at a picture of yourself as a baby. How similar are you physically? Not very. Now, what if I said to you, hey, you're a big Elvis fan, let's say, and I say, hey, I've got Elvis's car. I want to sell it to you. And you're like, dude, how much? And I'm like, I don't know, $750,000 for Elvis's car. And you're like, all right, I got a 750K. I'm going to buy it. So you come over to my house and you look at the car and you're like, okay, it's got to be a 1950 whatever car. And you start looking at it and you realize, wait a minute, those tires are new on the car. This can't be original. Whatever, he got new tires for Elvis's car. No big deal. Okay, and then you start to look at the rims and they're spinners. You're like, wait a minute, like, those weren't even invented. So those, whatever. Okay, so then you pop the hood and you look under the hood and you see it's a Honda engine. And it's a Honda transmission. And then you look inside and like it's been all reupholstered. And there's a CD player in there. And basically every physical part of Elvis's car was changed. Would you buy the car? No, because it's not the same car. It's not the same physical parts. Well, you're not the same physical person that you were a day ago, a week ago, a year ago, a decade ago, a life ago. You weren't the same person. So, why feel guilty about the past? You ever have anything that you did that you just felt totally guilty about? Why feel guilty? It wasn't you who did it. It was a lookalike. Why worry about the future? Like, I should really worry about my retirement. Really? Why? You won't be there when you get there. It'll be a different form of you. That's a replicant, you might say. Biological machine. And so this whole idea that we're responsible agents, that we have reason, that we have mental states, can you fathom? You've got to throw all this out the window. Is this an illusion? Lifelong identity is an illusion. Morality is an illusion. Reason is an illusion. Mental states are illusory. Or maybe naturalism is the illusion. How about that? Why would we throw out all of these first assumptions, all of these presuppositions about life and reality, and just so we can hold on to naturalism? That's why. We got to ditch reason, mental states, morality, and our own selves in order to hold on to our worldview. Oh, that would lead to despair, wouldn't it? Only if you were consistent with it. If you lived consistently with that view, it would lead to despair. It would have to. I'm not thinking anything. I don't have any reasons. There is no morality. I'm not the same person. There is no equality. There is no significance. The more consistent I was in my worldview, the less content I would be. The only way I could become more content in life is to be less consistent with my worldview. Here's Daniel Wegner, psychology department out of Harvard. He says, free will is an illusion, it's a very persistent illusion. It keeps coming back. Even though you know it's a trick, you get fooled every time. The feelings just don't go away. I'm kidding. almost like we do have free will. Galen Strawson, philosopher at the University of Reading. As a philosopher, I think the impossibility of free will and ultimate moral responsibility can be proved with complete certainty. It's just that I can't really live with this fact from day to day. Can you? Really? As for the scientists, they may accept it in their white coats, but I'm sure they're just like the rest of us when they're out in the world, convinced of the reality of radical free will. It seems that we cannot live or experience our choices as determined, even if determinism is true. No kidding. Rodney Brooks, he's famous for saying that humans are just a big bag of skin full of biochemicals. He says this, "When I look at my kids, my children, I can, when I force myself, see that they're just machines. But that's not how I treat them. I interact with them on an entirely different level." There you go. If I'm consistent, I'm not content. But if I'm content, it's only because I'm inconsistent. They have my unconditional love, the furthest one might be able to get from a rational analysis. How does he do it? He says, "I maintain two sets of inconsistent beliefs." Now, let me remind you, this is not at the periphery of your worldview. Like, where did Cain get his wife in Genesis 4? Okay, that's on the periphery. This is right at the heart and the soul of a worldview. And you're saying, "I'm going to give up significance, equality, morality, free will, mental states, reason, lifelong identity. I'm just going to throw all that out the window." If you throw that out the window, you no longer have a world or a worldview. There's no one to view it. Here's my caution as we close up. The goal, as Francis Schaeffer was so fond and eloquent as he put this, fond of saying and eloquent at putting this, the goal is not to have a smug superiority when you use a presuppositional apologetic. The goal is not to win an argument. I like to think of it in my mind as I talk to someone who's not a Christian. I like to think of it as I'm not across the table from him or her where we're arguing back and forth. I like to think of it as we're sitting on the same side of the table. And it's like we're looking at this together. How do you make sense of this? I kind of see it this way. What do you think? The goal isn't about winning the argument. Of course you're going to win. Okay, that's what I want you to think about with presuppositional apologetics. It's like you're going into playing poker and you've got four aces every time. You're gonna win, okay? That's not the problem. The problem is, you got the four aces. The problem is that you're scaring everyone off. They know you got the four aces. And so you're acting, you're betting. You gotta slowly bet and bid just a little bit at a time. And not to push a poker analogy too far, because in poker you're trying to take something from the person. What we're talking about here is you're trying to give something to them. But since we got the cards and we know we're going to win, we want to be as gentle and compassionate and respectful as we possibly can, lest we offend or scare people off, make them look stupid. In a sense, I guess what I'm saying here is we should be more concerned about winning the person, not winning the argument. When you really learn this stuff, you're not going to lose. But you could lose the person. And that would be a terrible loss.